Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello there. Sorry for the slightly erratic podcast schedule in recent weeks, but this one is worth the wait. Before we get into that, thank you so much for all your positive feedback on the last two specials, the addiction episode with Professor John Strang and the sugar episode with Dr. Charlotte Hardman. I'm really glad everyone's enjoying these bonus episodes where I talk to researchers and isn't just switching off when they realise there's no Scroobius Pip. So this one is another bonus one. I'm joined by another colleague from the University of Liverpool, Dr. Carl Roberts, to talk about cognitive enhancers or smart drugs. Carl and I are doing some research on this topic at the moment, so I thought who better to have a chat about these drugs with. So without further ado, Dr. Carl Roberts and I say why to cognitive enhancers.
Susie Gage.
Welcome to another episode of Say Why to Drugs. Today I am joined by my colleague Dr. Carl Roberts from the University of Liverpool.
Hello.
So Carl, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you do at your job?
Sure. I study the psychopharmacology of addiction and appetite. So I basically look at how drugs affect the brain and how in turn that kind of affects behaviour.
So psychopharmacology, the sort of the psychology of pharmacology, so the psychology of how drugs work?
Sure.
And the reason I have asked Carl to come on the podcast is to talk about cognitive enhancers. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what cognitive enhancers are?
Yeah, so generally cognitive enhancers are kind of understood to be pharmaceuticals which are used by people with healthy cognition or healthy normal IQ, I guess, to benefit them in some way and enhance their brain functioning. These are drugs that are prescribed drugs for other disorders that are mainly mild stimulants, really, that kind of get used by, often it's reported by like university students to help them study or to be able to kind of like concentrate for longer periods of time, to be able to retain information or to just basically enhance their ability to think, I suppose, or often by other people in the workplace as well to be able to perform at a level which might be better than normal or when they're sleep deprived and things like this.
Right. So am I right in thinking that there's a few different types of cognitive enhancer? It's not just one specific drug or drug class. It's like a few different ones, isn't it?
Yeah. So the main kind of ones that are getting the most attention, I suppose, are the ones that have been around the longest that we know a little bit more about, although even these ones we don't know a massive amount in terms of actual cognitive enhancement. But there are, the most common ones are kind of amphetamines or amphetamine derivatives, such as Adderall, which is kind of prescribed for ADHD. And then there is methylphenidate, which is better known as Ritalin, which is also prescribed in the UK for ADHD as well. And this has structural similarities to amphetamine as well. And then there is modafinil as well, which is getting an awful lot of attention. And this has a kind of, this is prescribed for sleep disorders, mainly narcolepsy. And again, this is, another mild stimulant. With a kind of more obscure pharmacology than the other two, the amphetamine derivatives. So Adderall and Ritalin tend to work on dopamine and noradrenaline. So they will increase kind of like dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, which is meant to underlie its effects on cognition. Whereas modafinil seems to work on dopamine as well as a load of other neurotransmitters as well. So it has kind of like much more complicated pharmacology, which we don't really understand fully yet.
So you mentioned that these drugs are prescribed for other things, but people have started taking them to try and get this cognitive enhancement effect. So they're sometimes known as smart drugs as well, aren't they?
Yeah. Smart drugs or nootropics as well is another one. Yeah.
Okay, so this we've maybe already answered this, but what's the appeal of cognitive enhancers? What's the appeal of smart drugs?
So I guess the appeal is the idea that it can improve concentration or the ability to perform tasks for people that are already... So say, for example, in the workplace, people are already performing at their kind of like maximum ability. They might take them because it might help them improve. So basically what we've got is the idea that people want to perform better or to gain some kind of advantage. For example, in an academic setting, they might want to use everything at their disposal to get an advantage over their peers. So whether that be, you know, kind of... So there's a lot of other ways you can do it, by kind of making sure you have good nutrition, being well rested, doing exercise. But if people might also decide that they wish to take some kind of pharmaceutical if they believe that that is... going to help them gain some kind of competitive advantage.
Yeah, a little bit of a shortcut. It's a bit easier to take a pill than it is to make sure you're fully rested if you're trying to meet deadlines and that kind of thing. So do we know much about who is using smart drugs? Do we know much about the prevalence of them or anything like that? Has that kind of research been done?
Well, no, basically is the answer. There are some, most of the information we've got on prevalence is from, survey data from, so mostly it's been done in, students. So I think that there was a survey done in one, it was either Oxford or Cambridge.
I think it was Oxford, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was by a newspaper, and they asked their students like about use of it. And there are other, surveys, generally aimed at students to kind of look at prevalence, but the way that they do it. So in terms of prevalence, when they've been asked, they basically ask these students if they have ever used these various drugs, or if they've used them in the last year or last month or something like this. They don't really kind of assess if they are actually being used to improve their performance in an exam or in the study period leading up to it, the pattern of use. We basically don't really have enough strong data on prevalence. Some newspaper reports and these surveys suggest that up to 20% of students in various universities are using them as study aids, but I'm not really sure that we can kind of make them claims
rely
from the study
that.
Data.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of media attention around these drugs at the moment, but actually we know very little about them, don't we? So we might... If 20% of the student population have ever used a nootropic, that doesn't necessarily mean that there are one in five people who are like using them every day to revise. This might be like people at university, people experiment with stuff quite a lot.
So they can have mild euphoric effects as well. They might just, you know, if people have been sleep deprived, or they could, you know, they might be using them as, you know, for their actual uses as well, for their clinical uses.
Yeah, that's a very good point, that these are actually prescribed to people for other things as well. What are the actual effects of these drugs then? Is it worth talking about the amphetamine derivatives and modafinil separately, or do you think the effects are broadly similar?
Yeah, so that's a really good point, actually. So assuming that they have a different pharmacological action, then it would make sense to assume that they they have a different effect on your behaviour or your cognition. So a lot of the times when people are talking about, you know, people using cognitive enhancers, then they will lump them together and say, you know, whether they, you know, oh, they do this, they do that. But in fact, you're right to make that distinction between them, yeah.
We've already done a podcast about amphetamines, so okay, That's probably worth going back and having a listen to as well. But what are the sort of short-term effects? If you take a cognitive enhancer, what can you expect to experience?
Well, I guess first and foremost, you'd probably expect to an increase in energy. So I think the most kind of reliable thing that you'll get out of these is that that you will kind of have increased wakefulness, I suppose, and that is kind of across the amphetamine derivatives, methylphenidate and modafinil as well. However, the differences in their effects on cognition are kind of, they're difficult to assess. Whilst there has been quite a lot of randomized controlled trials with each of these drugs, some of the problems with them studies are that they generally tend to assess the effect of a single dose, like you said, it's an acute study, and then kind of get them to perform some kind of cognitive task. So whether this be like a working memory task, a creativity task, or executive functioning task, or something like this. Now, the problem that you've got is that whether this actually translates over to how students are actually using them is quite difficult, really, because you would assume that if they are using them, that it would be over a kind of concentrated period of time to prepare for an exam. So a study assessing what a single dose does might not necessarily be particularly helpful.
Yeah.
But also the kind of tasks that they have been used, that have been used to assess their kind of effect on cognitive function, it's not really clear how much they actually translate again over to
Real world.
Yeah, yeah. Revision, I suppose, or, you know, kind of performance in the workplace as well.
Yeah, so I suppose we've kind of got two problems with doing research into smart drugs, is that actually we don't really know how people are using them, and we don't necessarily have good ways of modelling how people might be using them. So it's a little bit of sort of fumbling in the dark, really, at the moment in trying to work out, do smart drugs actually work?
Yeah, and I think that it's quite a common thing as well for the expectations of the drug to actually exceed the actual efficacy of them as well.
So was that like kind of like a placebo effect?
Well, potentially, but also the RCT data, basically a lot of it suggests that there are at best really modest effects on these various kind of cognitive tasks that they're doing, whereas you might get anecdotal reports of people saying that they're actually quite good as study aids or whatever, because they're not really kind of assessing the same thing.
But people are notoriously not very good at
judging their own kind of,
you know, yeah.
yeah.
So but, sort of it's obviously very important to find out what people experience when they use them, but that then translating to actual sort of measurable changes in cognition is a different story.
Yeah. Also, another kind of point is that it seems that there is this kind of U-shape in terms of effects of these drugs. So generally, people that have a lower baseline of cognitive ability or some kind of cognitive deficit, then these drugs might actually have a kind of restorative effect. They might be quite good, but if you're already performing at quite a high level, then the effects are much more subtle, or potentially even have a kind of like reduce your ability, have a, like a negative effect.
Oh, right. So some people might actually be using these and not getting any help, or potentially having problems.
Yeah, potentially.
I guess it's difficult because we don't know very much about these drugs. Are there any other effects, sort of short-term kind of intoxication effects from them? Because obviously amphetamines have quite a sort of strong intoxication effect. You get a lot of other sort of experiences as well as that kind of alertness. You also get like increased blood pressure and that kind of thing. These are obviously a lot milder than sort of something like speed, but do they still have any other effects in terms of the sort of alertness that they are likely to give? Do you think it's really more than something like a cup of coffee? Is that, I mean, it's obviously it's quite difficult to quantify like that, but there's a lot of debate at the moment around whether it's ethical to use smart drugs. But from what, I mean, and obviously there are, the evidence is it's pretty holy at the moment, and there's a lot that we still need to sort of do to find out really about these drugs. But currently the evidence doesn't really look like they're potentially that much more effective than like caffeine.
No. Or other herbal nootropics as well, like ginkgo biloba and things like this as well.
So do we know much? I mean, it seems like we know very little about the short-term effects, but what about the longer-term effects? I imagine, knowing what I know about other drugs literature, if we know very little about the short-term effects, we're probably going to know even less about the long-term effects of these drugs.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, in kind of healthy populations, and I don't think there's basically any research on long-term effects at all. If we're looking at short-term effects, so if we take looking at things other than cognition, obviously amphetamine derivatives and Ritalin are kind of, they have kind of like a toxicology history, and they kind of had cardiovascular effects as well. So I can't imagine that kind of repeated use over a long period of time is particularly good for you. I think that as far as I can make out, that modafinil is kind of like has less of these effects. But in terms of long-term effects on the brain and the body, then I just think there's such little evidence there, it's quite difficult to draw any conclusions, really.
Yeah, and I guess because they are medications for other conditions in their own right, then we probably do know quite a bit about how their sort of effects and side effects, when they're used by that population in the way that they're prescribed, but that's likely to be quite different from how people would use them as a cognitive enhancer. It would be much more, I mean, again, there isn't really very much evidence to sort of looking into this, but anecdotally, it seems like people use them for short bursts of time, but quite a lot over a short time, and then probably wouldn't use them for like the rest of the year, maybe even. So that's very different to if you're prescribed a medication and you take it, say, like once a day or however these medications are prescribed. So even if we know about the long-term effects in those populations, that doesn't necessarily translate to how these drugs could have long-term effects in people using them as cognitive enhancers.
Yeah, and you don't know if they're kind of taking them and having, like, you know, kind of a more intense kind of dosing regime affects that. So if they're taking, so say for example, if you had it in a population with ADHD and they're prescribed and they're having their one a day, what the difference is between that and somebody that's using it, they might be taking four or five in one day to kind of stay up and to do this. You don't know what cumulative effects these have, or whether larger kind of doses over a short period
have different profiles and different effects. Yeah,
but also the other thing is that in when they're kind of looking at harms and risks versus benefits, which is what these will generally be done for prescribed drugs, is that, you know, these kind of the point is that say for example, modafinil is only licensed for treatment of narcolepsy, so it has been investigated for its kind of risk, etc., cardiovascular risk, etc., in the short term, and the conclusion of the European Medicines Agency is that it's only suitable in terms of risk benefit to treat narcolepsy, which is a potentially fatal disorder. So I don't think that physicians would particularly have a favourable opinion of healthy people using it in terms of their to enhance their performance. So I think that it's difficult to understand the harms really, because you know, when they get classified as these medical drugs, then the risk benefit ratio is kind of, you know, they will give more, they'll be more lenient to them having restorative effects rather than having enhancement effects.
Yeah. I think that's a really important distinction to make, is like when you're prescribed a medication, we say it's to make you better, but actually that's sort of not what we mean. We mean it's to make you less bad. So medications aren't meant to take you above your sort of usual point, if that makes sense. I'm not sure I'm explaining this very well. But people are using these to try and like get a little bit extra. Yeah. So to make themselves better rather than to make themselves better. I'm really explaining this very, very badly.
To give them an edge rather than to make themselves well.
Yes. Well done. Thank you. So this then opens up the whole kind of question about the ethics of these drugs, because
And this debate is a humdinger.
So it's something that I talk about with the students that I teach as well. We've had big debates around the ethicality of using smart drugs, and a lot of people think it's unfair, this idea that you can give yourself an advantage by taking a pill. A lot of the students in particular feel very strongly that that's unfair, but I don't know. That makes a lot of assumptions.
Yeah, well, I think first of all, these are dilemmas that we'll kind of have to deal with more and more as these drugs inevitably get improved. So there's already an array of other cognitive enhancers which are kind of being developed. So things are being developed with the idea of enhancing cognition. And then I guess it's kind of there is an ethical debate on as to whether that is fair. So I guess kind of some of the things that the arguments that people kind of give for the idea that using these drugs is somehow cheating, especially like in terms of academic performance, I guess these because they basically think that if you produce a drug, so first of all we have to assume that a cognitive enhancer is effective,
that actually works.
So if it actually works, does somebody using an effective cognitive enhancer class as cheating in the run-up to an exam? So the idea is that it somehow creates so I read a paper that's talking about it, termed it as creating an uneven playing field, but the caveat to that was that it assumes that there was an even playing field to begin with. So 50% of your IQ is heritable, and generally other things which can improve your kind of academic performance or kind of grades and career, etc., come from home tuition and things like this. So a lot of people may not have had home tuition, but these are things that can
skew
things. So these are things that so there already is an uneven playing field that society kind of like generally accepts. So I guess if these were effective and were cost effective, then you might say, or maybe these are a good way of helping out more disadvantaged people
or
people with their biological handicap, if you will.
Yeah.
Whereas in reality, it's more likely that the same people that had home tuition are more likely to have the money to get these drugs
buy
anyway.
Smart drugs, yeah. But I think that's a really important point, is that when you go into an exam at the end of your schooling or your undergrad or whatever, no, you don't start from the same point. Some people have just had more time and money spent on their education and more time and money spent on their sort of nutrition and their health all while they're growing up, and just had more time to revise or whatever. And I think one of the key things to mention here about smart drugs is that you still have to do the actual work. It doesn't make you know things. You still have to read the papers. And so people use them to concentrate more while they're studying, but you still have to do the actual studying. It's not like a magic bullet.
I think some of the idea as well is that it can help you kind of be more motivated to do more arduous tasks, essentially. They appear to be stimulants which will make you kind of wakeful for longer, and help you become more motivated to do stuff that's dull, essentially.
There was an article in a newspaper, possibly The Guardian, a few weeks ago. I know we both saw it because we were talking about it on Twitter, but it was talking about mandatory drug testing before going into exams to find out whether people have been using smart drugs.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, certainly at the moment, I think we're an extremely long way away from that ever being a possibility, partly because we don't even know if they do actually give you any advantage. And so the idea of testing for something that could actually not be having any effect seems patently absurd to me. But what do I know? But it does seem like a bit of a slippery slope argument. It's saying if you think that you should drug test for cognitive enhancers, well, what about coffee or even something like nicotine that has been shown to have a mild cognitive enhancing effect? Mm. It's, yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts on mandatory drug testing?
Well, I think it's draconian anyway, isn't it? However, even if they were, it's completely untenable anyway, because even if they were to get you before, you know, before, line you up before you go into an exam and come and have a piss in a pot, then, and they tested that and they tested positive for that, then that's one thing. But ultimately, you would have to be testing everyone at regular points throughout the academic year, because people aren't just taking them to go into an exam with, they're taking them to revise with, the whole study period leading up to it. So to kind of like, just like the cost of that is like, it's just completely untenable, isn't it?
There's a step change between that kind of cognitive enhancers and something like doping professional sport.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a lot of the arguments kind of they're trying to relate it to doping in sport. But again, that's something that's like really, really badly controlled anyway.
But I suppose the flip side of that is this idea of potential feelings of coercion. That if you think that all of your peers who are going into the same exam as you have taken these cognitive enhancers, then you might feel genuine pressure to do so as well, because it is much more difficult. It's more difficult to get into university these days. You need better grades. It's more difficult to, you need to get a better degree. You're paying a small fortune for a degree. There is this pressure that if you feel like everyone else is getting this advantage, then you should do it too. And that's quite an argument against, or trying to enforce people to not use them.
They're still fairly hypothetical arguments, purely on the basis that that argument would assume that these drugs are effective and are producing some tangible improvement relative to people that aren't taking them, and also that the prevalence of them is incredibly high enough for the people that aren't using them to be in the minority and to think, oh, I better start doing these drugs. So, and also a kind of, you know, the other thing is, like you've mentioned before, like caffeine, nicotine, these are kind of understood to have some kind of cognitive enhancing effects. At least they are, again, mild stimulants. Mm-hmm. And these are kind of used quite widely, well, by the population as a whole, but you don't kind of see these, you know, I don't drink coffee, and I certainly don't feel the pressure to improve.
Yeah, and you
maybe I should start drinking it.
You work at a university where coffee is sort of the drug of choice, so that is even more impressive. What don't we know about cognitive enhancers?
Well, pretty much everything. I think that I think basically, if we would have just asked that as the first question, we could have got this. we could have just had this wrapped up pretty quickly. Essentially, I think that we know far more or less about any of these drugs than we actually do know, which I suppose is quite common, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, we basically need to know, especially like in terms of if people are kind of concerned about this being a public health problem, then first of all, we need to know the prevalence. We need to first, that's like one of the first things we need to know is this actually something that is really happening and to a really broad extent? Second of all, we don't know the harms really over like a chronic kind of period. We don't know if they're even particularly effective really, or in what domain they are. So again, you know, some might be different than others. They might improve performance in different areas of cognition. All of these things basically need researching.
Yeah. So basically we need to know kind of everything about,
we need to know everything about them. Yeah.
Who uses them, why, what they actually do, and more long-term, what the impact of taking them might be.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's not dissimilar to what we've talked about in lots of these other podcasts, that because these things are kind of illicit illicit is the right word, that people might not be willing to talk about their use, and that they've kind of sprung up being used as cognitive enhancers, and the research community has to sort of slightly scramble to keep up. It's quite a lot similar to the new psychoactive substances.
Well, yeah, very similar. I would say, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on that we don't have a handle on at all, really. The other thing is, if we go back to talking about risks, it's not even the risks that, you know, just from what we know about the way that the medication works itself, there's also additional risks in how people are obtaining these drugs. So people could be kind of faking medical problems, or alternatively, buying them off the internet. And again, you've got no control there over the reputability of the people that you're buying these drugs off, what's actually in them. And also, I think that they're, even with the even if prospective users or users of these drugs are aware of the actual drugs' harms, they seem to kind of underestimate them, I suppose, and use them.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a really good point, that actually there's sort of, there's more than one method that people use to get hold of these drugs, and some involve sort of deliberately going and lying to your GP, and that can potentially lead to all sorts of problems down the line of having that permanently on your medical record as well.
Yeah.
But also then, yeah, buying drugs off the internet where you, it's sort of the Wild West and you have no idea what you're actually buying. And we've talked about that in loads of other episodes, where the risks that you expose yourself to by taking an unknown substance could be anything. So it's, yeah, it's hugely dangerous behavior. Do you think there could be a role, if we can find cognitive enhancers that work, do you think there's a role for that? So could, for example, it be something like SSRIs, where SSRIs don't make you feel happy if you're already happy, if you know what I mean, but they can be really effective in some people. There'll be a whole episode about SSRIs where we can unpick this broad statement that I'm about to make, but they can be useful in treating depression. And cognitive enhancers, by the sounds of things, seem like they might be similar to that, in that they won't make you smarter if you're already smart, but if you're having sort of difficulties concentrating or difficulties learning, then maybe they can give you a boost, and that could potentially be really positive.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? These things are, like we say, there's countless other drugs that are kind of being found or being investigated, and you may come across something that is quite effective in various cognitive domains. And there is actually a potential for these drugs as cognitive enhancers, so produce something as a cognitive enhancer that may well benefit society as a whole. But we're not there yet.
Yeah, and then we can have the proper ethical debate about,
well, that's it, yeah.
If there actually is one that sort of works. Dr. Carl Roberts, thank you very, very much for coming and talking to us about cognitive enhancers.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So there we go. I have a feeling that this won't be the last episode about these types of drugs, as more research is carried out and we find out more about whether they're effective, who's using them, and what the long-term impacts of use might be. So, watch this space. In the meantime, there won't be any new episodes for the rest of the summer, as I'm jetting off to Japan next week for a conference and a bit of an explore. If there are any Japanese listeners, then do get in touch with me and give me some tips of where to go. But hopefully Pip and I will finally manage to meet up soon, and we'll have the next batch of episodes ready in the autumn. I'm also planning a roundup of new research and some updates where people have got in touch to point out some of the gaps in some of the existing podcasts. So thanks to everyone who has got in touch. It's always really, really good to know. In the meantime, find me at Sousaphone on Twitter, join the Facebook group Say Why to Drugs, and thanks again to everyone for their support. Thanks to Carl for giving up his Sunday to come and record this episode, and thanks to you all for listening. Take care now. Bye-bye then. You've been listening to Say Why to Drugs with me, Dr. Susie Gage. The music was by Jim Murray. The artwork was by @MyNameIsAd. Say Why to Drugs would not have been possible without the generous support of I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, the Medical Research Council, and Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces Network.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.